On this very important and information-packed episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we update you on some major news items in the ASC industry, including the wind-down of IMQ, a California-based accrediting organization, recent changes to the conditions for coverage that affect ASCs, including a major change to CRNA oversight, and a discussion of how you should be preparing a plan for next year, and we have an interview with Bob Zaza about starting up a new specialty.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 78 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for December 9th, 2019, recording from our studio in Spenceport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey. John is recognized as one of the nation's leading experts in all aspects of the ambulatory surgery industry, the author of the major books about the industry, and the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, the industry leader in ASC regulatory and accreditation governance and quality improvement oversight. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics.
So I'm a little tired. I got in at 2 o'clock in the morning from Las Vegas. I was at the Achieving Accreditation Conference for AAHC. So I see you've been doing a little bit of decorating while I've been gone.
I have been. It's a slow I'm very picky about these things. So I do a little bit, and then I walk by it, and I don't like it, so I change it.
And we have three Christmas trees in this house, three Christmas trees. But it is looking nice, Sue, so I know I've been absolutely no help this year. Haven't even been around. You know, the good news is when I drove up at 2 o'clock in the morning, it looked beautiful from the street with all those lights.
They just the trees.
Can't see that there's no, like, ornaments on the trees yet.
One of them has bows on it. They all have lights on them. But, of course, they come with lights on them.
That's so right. I can't really. Well, this is, as always, a busy week. We're heading down to the city this afternoon as soon as we finish this recording. And, of course, that means, Sue, that for those of you that don't know, Sue does all of the editing, what we call post-editing to make sure that we all sound normal in the podcast. So I think you're going to be doing that in the car. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
And so a couple things. First of all, I wanted to congratulate again Amherst Surgery Center. The grand opening reception was this last week. It's our new center in Buffalo, New York. And it is they just had an incredible grand opening reception and ribbon cutting. And I was very proud to be there.
And you have a video on LinkedIn showing that opening, right?
That's right. So if you're interested in seeing our new center there, please go to our LinkedIn account. And I did want to point out to everybody that if you're not a I don't think we call them friends, but if you're not a connection on LinkedIn, please do. We'd love to have you as a connection. Just search for my name, John Gailey, G-O-E-H-L-E, and I accept all LinkedIn connections. So, and then you can see the video both of the construction as well as the news coverage that we had of that opening. So again, Amherst Surgery Center, beautiful new place in Buffalo.
And as you mentioned, you were in Las Vegas this last weekend.
Yes. So I was there for the Achieving Accreditation Conference and surveyor training. Every 2 years, we get back in person with our fellow surveyors. There's about 300 of us. There's only about 50 in my cohort, I think. And it was a great opportunity to kind of see what's going on with AHHC and, you know, get to look at some of their new tools. I always enjoy spending time with my fellow surveyors. Sue, you were saying this morning that you hadn't heard from me in 2 days.
Because, I knew you must have been having a good time and just reconnecting with all your...
Yeah, and of course, it was three time zones away, so that that made it very difficult to connect with you. Sorry about that. And, I'm still surprised, Sue, at how many people still don't know about our podcast.
Shocking.
It is, especially, you know, my fellow surveyors. So we did spend some time talking to HHHC about how we can get the word out to more people, including the HHHC surveyed organizations and other surveyors. So they're going to help us out a little bit on that. And of course, I spoke as much as I could to everybody I could see about the podcast. But I guess it just goes to show we really need to spread the word. We're doing a little bit of advertising for it, but the best word really comes from other people telling their friends about it. So please spread the word about our podcast. And of course, you know, we always say this at the end, hit that subscribe button and leave us a positive review. Also, that always helps to get the word out. We have 5 stars for our podcast here, and we're very proud of that. But the more the merrier. So please do that. Sue, you have a Christmas store.
Well, we put something up on the podcast website, just some ideas for nurses or other medical people for Christmas. And we're going to keep working on that and maybe adding just different products that we
not just for Christmas, use, right? You had way too much fun with Christmas, though. I can see there's a whole bunch of Christmas ideas. So,
yep. And I even bought for us one of the games that I had put on there. Yeah. So I'll be trying it out. I think it's about cells and cell biology and that kind of thing. So a little nerdy, but
yeah, very nerdy.
I do like that thing. But yeah, there's a lot of ideas. And like I said, we're going to kind of keep working on it. It may not all be based on medical type things, but just, you know, some things that we recommend that we'd like.
So yeah, please visit the website at ascpodcast.com. There's a lot of great information up there in addition to access to our store where you can buy Christmas gifts for your staff or for other people in your family or friends that are in the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, there's all kinds of product links for things that you need in the surgery center as well as our books. Mm-hmm. And probably a good thing to mention the patron membership here, which is available also on the ascpodcast.com. If you become a patron member for as little as $10 a month, you get additional content, discounts, really deep discounts on books and mock surveys, and of course, AEU credits if you are a certified ambulatory surgery center administrator. So again, visit our website at ascpodcast.com. I also want to mention that we've had some extensive conversations in the last couple weeks with both HHHC and ASC Association. And we have been talking, or at least starting a conversation with Joint Commission also. With the ASC Association, we're working on some finance content. I have a new book about finance, hopefully coming out in the next 3 months. We're developing some premium finance content for people that want to learn more about the finance aspect of ASCs. We're working with ASC Association and MedTrainer on that. There's also going to be an update to the survey guide very shortly. We have been waiting for the new official interpretive guidelines from CMS, but since that doesn't seem like it'll come out until probably the end of the first quarter or the second quarter, we really can't hold off on it anymore. So we'll be updating that within the next couple weeks and republishing the survey guide soon. So by the way, this is going to be an information-packed episode. There's just so much to talk about here. So we'll keep you informed on the podcast. Watch the websites also for any changes there. But our relationship with ASC Association continues. We're trying to publish some books and, of course, working with the podcast and some premium content in all aspects, not only finance. That's all developing as we speak. And Sue, next week we have our semi-annual Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies Retreat. You plan a lot of the stuff for the winter seminar, mainly because you do all the – we also combine it with our Christmas party.
Yes.
So. Want to talk a little bit about what you're planning for us, other than that game?
Well, we can play some of those games, and I ordered a Christmas trivia thing that we could play as well.
Not again.
but a lot of it is going to be educational, so we're all kind of trying to gather our thoughts of what we'd like to learn a little more about, kind of strategize about, and you know some of the developments that happen over the year that we try to implement into
by the beginning of the next year.
Yeah.
Which really comes to the topic of this week's episode here, which is, you know, really planning for the next year and taking the time. I can't emphasize enough the importance of taking some time out of your day, out of your week, you know, out of your year to sit down and purposely think about what you're going to be doing in the next year. So we'll talk a little bit about that in our second segment here. But that's what we do at Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. Mm-hmm. That's what we do on the podcast, frankly. You know, it's periodic. periodically step back and take the time to purposely think through what we're doing, how we can improve on it, and making the changes. So that's what the purpose of our two-day retreat will be. And, of course, we combine it with some fun to make sure that
and food. People
don't get bored. And a lot of food.
We are going to have food, too.
Yes.
I forgot to even mention that.
That kind of goes without saying.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about some recent issues. So something came up this last week. Well, it actually came up during the AAAC seminar where we were talking about immediate jeopardy. And we're actually going to talk a little bit more detail next week on immediate jeopardy. But I did want to point out something that's kind of pertinent this time of year is that there was an organization that actually had an immediate jeopardy situation. Immediate jeopardy is when you are told that you cannot continue to function unless you fix this problem right away. And what had happened is they had a portable heating unit in the clinical area, in the patient care areas. And, you know, of course, when you live in upstate New York, you know, with our cold temperatures, this, you know, it can be cold in some areas. So somebody had put in a portable heating unit. This is like a unit like we have actually in our podcast room here that you just set on the floor that's independent. We can do it here because it's not a healthcare organization, but in an ambulatory surgery center, you cannot have anything like that in the patient care area. And they were issued an immediate jeopardy. So please recognize the importance of really following those rules and understanding that immediate jeopardy is a pretty serious situation.
So were they able to just remove that and make a plan not to have that back in there again?
That's a good point. So when immediate jeopardy is threatened, basically what you do is you have to come up with an immediate plan in order to rectify it so that you're actually not shut down. And what they did in this situation, as I understand it, and this is secondhand information, is that they wrote a plan up and they threw out the unit and they went out. The other problem they had is they didn't have any fire extinguishers in the entire center. So they somebody rushed down to the hardware store, picked up a fire extinguisher, and then they got rid of the unit and were able to put it down. But, of course, it still ended up being a citation. It ended up something that they had to put together a plan of correction to assure it would never happen again in the future.
Yeah, so even if you get something that you can resolve very quickly, it's a bad mark on the center, and probably they dig even deeper in other areas just because they get concerned.
It's rare that I find it when I'm doing a survey, but when I'm preparing people for surveys, I'm kind of shocked at the number of times I find these portable heating units or portable air conditioning units during the summertime or fans or things like that that really are not allowed in the inpatient care areas. So if you don't know the rules, please look them up. Check with the you know, an NFPA guidelines on this and recognize that that's not acceptable.
And we saw some communication from HHC in November that we didn't get a chance to talk about.
Correct. So we talked about this when we talked to Taryn from HHC about three episodes ago. So HHC issued a letter in November to their accredited organizations, and I'll just read in part what they said. As you are aware, CMS recently revised the requirements of 41641B regarding hospital transfer agreements and physicians with admitting privileges. For 41652A1 regarding the pre-surgical history and physical, and 41654 regarding emergency preparedness plans and drills. These changes are effective November 29th, 2019, at which time all ASCs subject to CMS surveys will be expected to be in full compliance. HHC went on to say, please note at this time, the HHC 2018 Accreditation Handbook for Ambulatory Healthcare and HHC 2017-18 Accreditation Handbook for Deemed Status Surveys remains unchanged. The only proposed revision related to these conditions for coverage that HHC intends to submit to CMS is a specific language consistent with the recently adopted CMS rule requiring ASCs to have a history and physical policy. The policy would be expected to comply with all elements of the current HHC standard. HHC will notify organizations of any CMS-approved changes to the HHC standards. So again, I really want to emphasize this, not just with HHC, but with the other accrediting organizations, that even though CMS has come back and made some changes to the CFCs, HHC and many of the other accrediting organizations, and you need to check with them, continue to hold ASCs to that higher standard, requiring a comprehensive history and physical, requiring a transfer agreement, et cetera, or there's alternatives to the transfer agreement. So make sure that you're well aware of what the accrediting organization standards are and are in full compliance, regardless of what CMS's changes are. Now, some of these things will be resolved over time, but nonetheless, I really don't expect HHC to lower the standard with H&Ps. And of course, the transfer agreement standard requires something interesting here. Even though it doesn't require, CMS isn't requiring you to have a transfer agreement in the future, they do require you, however, to communicate with the local hospital about your existence, basically, on a periodic basis. So that will be in addition to whatever else you're doing with regard to the transfer agreement. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned. We'll keep you informed about any of those changes. So we do have an update on the IMQ situation. As we discussed last week, IMQ is winding down their operations. They are a California-based accrediting organization. They accredit a number of ambulatory surgery centers throughout the country, mostly in California. And as we reported last week, they are phasing out their accreditation program, which would include their deemed status accreditation program. Mm-hmm. And they've been working very closely with the Joint Commission to help transition organizations to another accrediting organization. I will say, based upon my conversations with HHHC over the weekend, HHHC is also working with IMQ to transition some organizations from IMQ to HHHC. So all of the accrediting organizations are interested in speaking to IMQ organizations about a transition.
And the Joint Commission and HHHC look like they're planning some seminars to kind of help people to make that transition. So we'll give you those dates in a future episode. Those are upcoming.
So we actually have a conversation scheduled sometime this afternoon mm-hmm. with Joint Commission where we'll talk to them a little bit more about it. I have talked to HHHC. We are going to do a special episode actually with them in January regarding transitions in general, not just to HHHC, but you know, how do you transition from one accrediting organization to another, or how do you move from deemed status to non-deemed status? So that'll be sometime in January, and I'm sure that Joint Commission will also be interested in talking to us about transitions too. So stay tuned for more information about that. But if you are an IMQ accredited organization, you have a lot of options available to you, both through the Joint Commission, through HHHC, and I'm assuming through QuadASF, though I haven't seen any information from them yet. And we want to help you on the podcast here to make some of those decisions and give you as much information about the timing as we can.
There were some changes to the CMS conditions for coverage regarding the requirements for CRNA monitoring.
So this one came as a bit of a surprise to a lot of us, not because we didn't expect some change in the future. We just were surprised that it didn't show up so notably. It was actually hidden in the physician fee schedule legislation. So this is what's happening. Let's see if I can explain it. Right now, if you are a CRNA in most states, you cannot operate in an ambulatory surgery center independently. Now, there are exceptions. I think there's about 18 states that allow CRNAs to operate independently. But if you are in a state that you're not allowed to operate independently, you have to, everything that you do has to be basically under the supervision of a physician. Now, that can be an anesthesiologist or it can be the surgeon. So there's several aspects to this, which would include the pre-op anesthesia assessment, as well as the supervision of the procedure itself, and of course, the supervision of the discharge of the patient. So the only thing that has really changed is that the anesthesia assessment now can be done independently by the CRNA. So in the past, that was one of those documents that had to be signed off by a physician. So effective January 1st, 2020, a CRNA is able to do the anesthesia assessment without a countersignature by a physician. So that is a pretty major change. It will, of course, increase the efficiency of the operation. However, keep in mind that the CRNA is still under the supervision of the physician for other aspects of the care that's being rendered in all states where a CRNA is not able to practice independently. So again, I need to emphasize that there are certain states, and Sue, we probably better have another whole section on this at some point mm-hmm. where we talk about the CRNA rules. There are approximately, I think it's 18 states, where a CRNA is able to independently practice. There's no change in those states because they already are able to sign off in the preoperative anesthesia assessment and all their aspects of the care. The only change this is going to have is for those other states that where a CRNA is not able to independently practice. So I know that's a bit confusing. Again, I think we'll try to schedule a discussion about CRNAs and anesthesia in general in an upcoming episode. We have so many things to talk about.
And John, what other news do you have from the Triple HC retraining?
So, first of all, I did talk to Noah Adachi, who is the president and CEO at Triple HC, and we kind of agreed that calling that retraining is probably not the appropriate term because, you know, we get together on a regular basis to get follow-ups on things that are going on in the survey arena, look at the technology that we have, and that's really where a lot of the changes have occurred. Triple HC is going through some pretty significant technological upgrades, which are very exciting, by the way, which helps us as surveyors as well as the accredited organizations to be better prepared for their surveys and to respond to, well, to prepare their applications and respond to survey results.
It's more of an updating than a retraining.
That's correct. That's correct. And we get a lot of training as Triple HC surveyors. And a lot of our conversation was about how we're working to improve or to decrease the amount of variability in the survey results, which we know has been a problem. And it's not just with Triple HC, it's with all accrediting organizations and all surveyors in general. So we're just spending a lot of time at Triple HC talking about that. So I'm very excited about it. It was a very good session, and there was quite a number of conversations about various aspects. One thing that I thought was very interesting is we had an extensive discussion about plans of correction. So if you're an accredited organization that's going through deemed status, you have to do a plan of correction at the end of the survey, assuming, of course, which you always do, you have some types of deficiencies that are noted. But an organization that is not deemed status in the past had not been required to submit a plan of correction to Triple HC. But Triple HC during this session, or the leaders that were talking during the session, pointed out that you are required under your accreditation standards to prepare a plan of correction, even though it's not submitted to the Triple HC, and your need to have that plan of correction available to Triple HC if they request it, and certainly to be able to submit that to the surveyors when they show up at the next accrediting event. And this is no different in the other organizations. Certainly, Joint Commission and Quad ASF has similar rules. Sometimes people forget that they need to have this documented. So it's not just doing the plan of correction, it's making sure it's documented. So here's my recommendation, is that at the end of an accreditation survey, if you are not deemed status and you're not required to submit a plan of correction to the accrediting organization, you still prepare one and include it in your quality improvement minutes. And this is what we at Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies do, is we include in the minutes of the Quality Improvement Committee a list of all of the citations, much more summarized. We don't do the whole, you know, verbiage that comes out of the report, but we have a summary of all of those things that came up, as well as the current status of it. And I think that's a good way to document the work that you've done, and also to continue to remind everybody of what had been found during the previous survey. So this is a good exercise for everybody to go through.
You're usually given a chance to fix things when they find on the initial survey, but if they come back and you haven't fixed the thing that you have already been cited for, it's much more serious.
That's right. And that was another topic of conversation, extensive conversation during this meeting of Triple HC, where we talked about how, you know, there are going to be consequences to organizations that do not implement those changes that they were required to make. I mean, obviously, you have to do it in a deemed status situation, but even in non-deemed status surveys, we need to make sure that those things that are identified in previous surveys as a deficiency are followed up on. And the best way to do that is to document it through this process and continuously monitor it to make sure those changes are made. Mm-hmm. And what we've been saying is that in the future, if those changes are found to still exist at a future survey, there will be much more dire consequences. I mean, it's probably not a good term there, but it's certainly going to be looked on quite unfavorably in that situation.
And it's so easy, I think, to just fall back, even if you fix it and you have great intentions to begin with. If you're not constantly bringing it back to mind, it's very easy to fall back into your old habits.
That's right. That's right. So again, the takeaway here is include it in your quality improvement minutes. Talk about it on an ongoing basis. Remind yourselves of those things that were found during the most recent survey, and make sure that you don't fall back into those other patterns. I do have an update from MedPAC, the MedPAC panel, and you might know that MedPAC is an organization that works with Congress to make proposed changes to the Medicare program. So the Medicare panel, MedPAC, met in December of this month, just recently. And unfortunately, again, they are proposing some changes that are not good for the industry. And the big thing is that MedPAC believes that physicians and ambulatory surgery centers are adequately compensated. And the commission has made a recommendation to Congress to make no payment update in 2021 to the Medicare payment rate. Now, in the past, they have made these recommendations, and there really has been, you know, Congress hasn't really taken that into consideration, and certainly the CMS hasn't always adopted these principles. But MedPAC has drafted a proposal for a smaller hike for both hospitals and no hike for ambulatory surgery centers. So it's going to be interesting in January what debate continues on that and how Congress is, and CMS is going to react to it. MedPAC also continues to push for cost reporting for ambulatory surgery centers. So that's another area that we're going to keep a very close eye on to see what will happen. We've mentioned this in previous episodes where we, especially with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, have a lot of experience in working on cost reports in the state of New York, which is the only state in the country that currently requires them. It is a very onerous process. It's very time-consuming. It's expensive for the organizations. But MedPAC continues to encourage CMS to consider doing these cost reports. So let's, again, keep an eye on that. Okay, we're going to take a break here, and then we'll come back and start talking about planning for the future. We're also going to have an interview with our friend Bob Zaza about implementing new programs. So I think these are all good conversations to have as we enter into the new year. So a couple weeks ago, I was meeting with a prospective client who I've known for a number of years and who has owned an ambulatory surgery center in the past but hasn't been the sole owner of it. And now he's building a brand new center, and he's going to end up becoming, you know, solely responsible for all aspects of the management and ownership and administration of this center. And I told him that we have a weekly podcast that we talk about all kinds of issues revolving around the ambulatory surgery industry.
It's funny because you said that he had the same question that I did when we first started. I said, how are we going to do this? What, you know, we can cover it in 5 or 10 episodes. How are we going to keep going? But there's always more information.
And that's it. I literally was kind of speechless when he asked me that question, because to me, there's so much to talk about. Look at this episode alone. You know, we've had to pile a whole bunch of information into this episode, and this happens periodically. You know, granted, there are some weeks where, you know, the news is a little sparse, but for the most part, there's always something to talk about. There's always, you know, changes that are occurring, and there's always issues that we want to emphasize in the podcast. And this gets really to the heart of planning. We can't just assume that we can operate or we can manage a center without having some type of a plan, without looking at all the information that we have available to us about the industry and working out a way to make sure that we're always compliant, that we still make money. You know, obviously, that's important to assure, you know, the ongoing existence of our centers.
And reassessing to see if there's any new rules, any new regulations. Which is why you talk about this at the beginning of the year, because, you know, that's you right. Always have to be looking back at your plan.
And of course, this is a very dynamic industry. There's a lot going on. Planning is absolutely essential. And I think one of the problems that we have is we get wrapped up with crisis management. I like to say when I was an administrator that I felt like I was more of a firefighter than an administrator, that I was constantly putting out fires in the organization. And that I really felt often that I didn't have time to plan because mm-hmm. I was just dealing with day-to-day crisis management or important issues that were going on that I felt took away from my planning activities.
So you want to be proactive and not reacting to That's all right. of the crises that come up.
That's exactly right. So that gets to the issue that we're talking about this week, which is strategic planning. Or if you don't like using the term strategic planning, like, you know, those of us with master's degrees in business administration are taught to talk about, why don't you just think about it in terms of how do we set our goals and objectives for a period of time? How do we establish a plan so that we are proactive as opposed to being reactive? So let's dive into it. And I think it's important to note that this isn't just something we do in order to operate our facilities efficiently and according to the regulations, but the accrediting organizations and indeed CMS do require us to do planning, to have goals and objectives, to have, shall we say, a strategic plan. So Sue, why don't you review some of those requirements?
Okay, so for the requirements for strategic planning, HHHC states that the governing body is responsible for formulating long-range plans in accordance with the mission, goals, and objectives of the organization. The Joint Commission refers to goals and objectives in both the environment of care and the leadership chapters, where they refer to how the organization's goals and objectives drive the plans for the organization as well as the budget. And CMS refers to, in 416.41, governing body and management. The ASC must have a governing body that assumes full legal responsibility for determining, implementing, and monitoring policies governing the ASC's total operation. The governing body has oversight and accountability for the quality assessment and performance improvement program, ensures that the facility, policies, and programs are administered so as to provide quality health care in a safe environment, and develops and maintains a disaster preparedness plan.
So while it doesn't specifically state that you have to have a strategic plan or goals and objectives, it certainly implies that in that language. And how else are we going to be able to demonstrate that we are planning for the future and preparing our organization's quality improvement program, risk management program, disaster preparedness program, if we don't set some type of goals and objectives for those programs?
Yeah. So now that we know all the requirements and what everybody expects of us, how do you actually do this? You know, a lot of administrators don't really have that extra time. They're rushing around all day long. How do you, you know, give us some steps and what we have to do?
Sure. A tall order, by the way. you know, your plan can be either complex or simple. I'm going to start out with a complex plan because realistically, nobody's going to do this. But if you do have the time to do it, here's what you do. If you have the time and the resources, you do a SWOT analysis. That's SWOT, and that stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And even if you don't do a formal plan like I'm talking about here and a more simplistic plan, you should always be thinking about SWOT. You should always be thinking about, you know, what are your organization's strengths, weaknesses, you know, what is happening in the marketplace that might be a threat to you in the future. So you might not formally write these things down, but you should be thinking about SWOT. So if you have the time and resources, you just really should sit down and take a day or so, like we do, you know, in our organization where we have a retreat, and you go through your SWOT and you put together a plan. You develop a comprehensive set of goals and objectives and write them into a formal document. And when you're putting that SWOT analysis down, what you're really trying to do is look at your strengths and your weaknesses and try to figure out how you can capitalize on your strengths, minimize your weaknesses, or turn your weaknesses around, identify those opportunities for the future, such as new programs that you might be able to develop, and what those threats are, what's going on in the marketplace, you know, what new competition is out there, and how are you going to react to it. And then you use these goals and objectives as something that you refer to throughout the year and report on them at each meeting. So what I'm proposing here is that if you have the time and resources to do a formal plan such as this, you take a time to debate or discuss with your management team and the organization's governing body all of those things that you want to accomplish over the next year and how you're going to accomplish it given the resources that you have in your organization and given the marketplace and what's happening out there. Even if you can't do a retreat or get the board away or the management team away for some time, you can do it on your own. Now, when I was an administrator for 17 years, quite frankly, my governing bodies, they really didn't have the time or the inclination to, you know, sit down in a retreat. And, you know, that was kind of unfortunate, but I recognized that was the environment I worked in. So I did it. You know, I took the time. I put all of the stuff together. You know, I did the SWOT analysis. I did take the time out of my busy day, you know, a couple hours a day over a week or so to put together the SWOT analysis, to analyze the marketplace, to do research, to look at the organization, to get statistics about how well we were doing and what things we were doing particularly well. We looked at the budget. We looked at the operational statistics. We looked at our quality improvement statistics. We looked at our satisfaction surveys, and we figured out what we did well and what we really could improve upon and what opportunities were out there, what was happening with our competition, what could we capitalize in the market marketplace? Where were there weaknesses? Where were there some opportunities for new programs to be developed? What was happening in the industry? You know, what new programs were moving out of the hospital and into the surgery center? And then I developed this plan. And my reports were quite long. You know, my strategic plan would go for 5 or 6 pages. And then I would take this plan to the governing body, and then we would debate it. You know, I'd provide it before the board meeting and then have a conversation at the board meeting and kind of lead them through the process. And then in the end, they either agreed or disagreed with me or, you know, accepted part of the plan. But it was always a good exercise. It was always something that they took seriously when they realized how serious it was to me. And then this became my goals and objectives. We know that, and as an administrator, as a nurse manager, you should have performance evaluations done. But that's not always done because you're reporting to the governing body, and who at the governing body level is going to actually sit down and do this. So this strategic plan became my sets of goals and objectives for my job and became the performance report. You know, at the end of the year when I reported to the governing body the success of the strategic plan, that became my performance evaluation. It helped identify how successful or not successful I was in all of the different aspects that we established at the beginning of the year as part of the strategic plan.
Okay, so now we're all completely overwhelmed by all of this. So let's move on to the simple. What can you do? And I'm sure you also can do sort of a combination of, you know, picking out some of the parts that you just talked about. Give us a little easier step-by-step.
Yeah, I think what Sue's trying to say is that she's bringing me up off the ceiling now down to the ground because I get very passionate when I talk about strategic planning. My master's degree, my business administration master's degree was in strategic planning, and it's something I'm very passionate about. But I recognize that many of you administrators out there and nurse managers literally don't have time for lunch, let alone time to sit down and do this plan. So it doesn't need to be this formal. It needs to be in writing in some way. It doesn't need to be this 7-page document or however long those things were. We talk about in management school how, you know, a strategic plan can even be on the back of the napkin. And indeed, many of the best plans that have been developed over the years by geniuses in the business community have written things on the back of a napkin. So don't feel like you have to do it as formally as I just espoused. But think about how you would actually sit down and do this. So for many of our clients, it's as simple as just setting a few goals. And at a minimum, I would try to break it down into 4 different areas. So those 4 areas are regulatory, financial, operational, and quality improvement, risk management, and infection control. So let's go through each of those individually. From a regulatory standpoint, the goals that you're probably going to set there are going to be to maintain your Medicare certification and, if it's required, your accreditation, or if it's something you choose to do. So really, all of our centers have this as one of their goals, is to maintain that certification and accreditation. Talk about those steps. And then as part of that, to outline the steps that they're going to do throughout the year or the next couple years, if the plan is more than 1 year, to maintain that accreditation and certification. So who's going to do this? Who's going to go through the accreditation manual? You should be reading that every year to make sure that you're, you know, making changes that are required as a result of changes in the accreditation standards or changes in your organization that affect your ability to maintain your accreditation. Somebody should be reviewing all of the certification requirements. We just talked earlier in this episode about, you know, a change in the CMS standards or a number of changes in the CMS standards. Who's reviewing that in your organization? What are you doing? Who's going to be responsible for changing the policies and procedures if necessary? Who's going to do that research? And, you know, kind of talking about our business a little bit, mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're not going to be able to maintain all that information. Maybe you're going to need some help from an outside consultant. You know, who are you going to hire? How are you going to go about getting that expertise? So again, for the regulatory standpoint, usually we talk about accreditation and certification. Now, if you're an organization that isn't yet accredited, maybe one of your goals is to seek accreditation. So your goals and objectives reflect your goal to get accreditation. And then as part of the objectives there, you're going to have to research the different organizations, try to figure out a plan and a time frame for achieving accreditation. And what are you going to do? How are you going to go about doing that? Are you going to go through each of the chapters in the accreditation handbooks out there? Who's going to be responsible for that? So again, all of those things would be established as part of your strategic plan here in a very written down in, you know, maybe just bullet points, but outline all the steps that you're going to do. So that's one of the 4 areas. So the second area is going to be financial. And as we joke about often, this is the main focus of any board meeting. So you won't have any problem getting the doctors to set goals in the financial area. And I'll be realistic. In most of our centers, again, they have the same goals and objectives no matter where they're located. And that usually says recruit more doctors or identify new surgeons that might want to work at your place. So you're goals and objectives must establish, how you're going to do that, who's going to be responsible for it, and a time frame for carrying out those duties.
This makes me think of a center we were at where, of course, at every board meeting, the doctors want to recruit more doctors. They know that's the route to improve their finances. But until it was written down, and the administrator actually brought up at one of the board meetings, okay, last time this was our goal to contact this doctor or that doctor, and really brought them around to what are you doing concretely, to make this happen. And so I think your idea of writing it down, making it formal is really important to turn it from a, just a wish or a, oh, we should do this, to really it's a goal, let's be accountable.
And you give a good example here, because that particular administrator is really sharp. She's really on the ball. She's relatively new to the administration, and she actually takes the strategic planning process very seriously. Mm-hmm. And as you said, she's holding them accountable. So the strategic plan says that they're going to do this. They clearly set on the doctors a responsibility for identifying the people and at least making the primary contact. And what's happened, unfortunately, at each of these board meetings, they say, well, I'll take care of it, next quarter, and then they don't do that. So she's holding them accountable, referring back to the strategic plan at all times to say, this is what we all agreed on, guys, at the very beginning of the year. How are we going to carry that out? So again, we're talking about four areas. Regulatory was first, financial was second. Let's talk about operational, which would be the third item. So for an example here, this really does vary by organization. For example, you might look at your operation and say, I want to reduce my turnover time. I want to reduce my wait time, because these are things that I've identified in our operation that are a problem. Turnover time seems to be obviously a very big issue in ambulatory surgery center, because that's one of the things that sets us aside from other organizations or from the hospitals. So that's a very reasonable goal. So if you look at your organization and you identify an issue with regard to turnover time, that might be a goal that you establish. You want to reduce your turnover time to a certain number from wherever it is before. And by the way, this could very well turn into a quality improvement study also. So there is often a tie-in, a direct tie-in between the strategic plan you're establishing and particular quality improvement studies that you might be developing. And again, the issue comes down to, once you write this down, you have to hold people accountable. Who is going to be developing a plan for reducing that program? And how are you going to carry that out? So you'll have the goal of reducing the turnover time. How are you going to actually do that? So, I mean, I'm obviously just giving very high level, and relatively simplistic examples of what you might do. But it will get you in the habit of establishing goals and objectives and holding people responsible for this. And then also that responsibility and accountability for reporting this back to the Quality Improvement Committee and the governing body. And then the fourth area is quality improvement, infection control, and risk management. And these are areas that are actually really required to have goals and objectives established in both the CMS standards and the accreditation standards. And so what you, at the very minimum, have here is goals established for the quality improvement program for the next year, goals established for the infection control program for the next year, goals established for the risk management and safety program. So those three areas in particular, and emergency preparedness. And what you'll want to do here is identify what happened in the prior year. And based upon what happened in that prior year, so for example, maybe in the infection control area, you found that your infection rate went up. What are you going to do in order to reduce those that infection rate? Establish that right in your strategic plan, right in your goals and objectives for the next year. And again, not only state you want to accomplish, but how you're going to accomplish that in the objectives.
So I know you said sometimes it comes out at 7 pages, but yeah, if we're shortening it up, what exactly should it look like? How should it be set up?
So there's two ways that I see that you can do this. And you know, Sue, in our organization, we do it a couple ways. Either we have a 1 or a 2 page set of goals and objectives for the next year. And that's probably the more ideal way, because you can pull it out of the minutes and you can, hang it up even in your organization. And you can turn that document, usually a Word document, into a working tool where you not only show what the goals and objectives are, are, but also talk about what you've accomplished in the time since the last meeting. The other way you can do it, and the way we do it with some of our smaller centers who don't have a lot of goals and objectives because they're just not that large, we actually write it into the minutes. And mm-hmm. there's a section in the governing body minutes where we establish the goals and objectives for the next year. And every quarter, we report on what's going on. And that's why it's built right into the minutes. But remember, again, to hold people accountable to this, to make sure that you don't gloss over this at the meetings, to good or bad. You know, if you find that nothing has been accomplished during the last quarter, you're not being judgmental about it, but you say, hey, listen, you know, I know we've been tied up in a lot of operational issues, or we've had some regulatory things that we've had to deal with, like a survey, but now it's time to get back to the goals and objectives that we've established for the organization for the year. Let's get back to this task, and let's make sure that we've set assignments for the next period.
Is it okay to reassess and change the goals, or should you always, do you want to make sure that you keep to those?
That's a really good question, and I think, you know, you have to be flexible mm-hmm. with establishing a strategic plan and the goals and objectives. You have to recognize that things are going to happen throughout the year that might force you to go back and evaluate what you've written down in the beginning. I encourage places to not do this on the cuff. You know, mm-hmm. you want to really be able to be very pragmatic about the process. Try to establish goals and objectives that will last the year.
Mm-hmm. That will be attainable, too.
That will be attainable. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And in some future episode, I think we'll go into the SMART goals and objectives. You and I were talking about mm-hmm. that before the podcast mm-hmm. is how deep do we want to get into it? But we're already at, 23 minutes here on okay. the conversation. And I'm afraid, you know, this is a topic that we could talk for days on. Mm-hmm. I think my objective, my goal and objective in this discussion here is to show that this is something, number one, that you have to do because you're required to do it as part mm-hmm. of CMS. Number two, it's something that's really beneficial to your organization. Number three, it's something that helps to hold people accountable, including your governing body. There is some responsibility that the governing body has here. And if you don't write this down, it's going to be hard for an administrator to go back and say, hey, guys, this is what you promised me. You promised that you were going to help me go and recruit, if I'm the administrator, go out and recruit new doctors. Mm-hmm. You haven't done this yet. Please help me. And we agreed to this in the beginning of the year. Likewise, when you're going to your staff and you give them a set of goals and objectives for the year, if you're not holding them accountable to it, it's not going to get done. Mm-hmm. And this is no secret. Once the strategic plan is done, it's not something you throw into the drawer and say, okay, I'll revisit this every quarter. This is something you want to publish. You want to make it, you know, something that you're holding yourself accountable to. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of a silly example, but, you know, in March of this year, I decided I was going to lose weight and, you know, went on a program to lose this weight. And the way that I knew that I would be held accountable for this is by telling people that this was my goal. And, you know, now I have a whole cadre of people that are holding me responsible for that. Same thing with goals and objectives in an organization. If you don't go off and tell people that this is what you're going to do, there's no accountability there. So now that you have a strategic plan or a set of goals and objectives, and again, at the end of the year, you should be looking back at your financial situation. Now, in episode 48, we talked about budgeting and financial planning, and we've referred to it a number of times over the last year. But everything eventually ends up coming down to dollars and cents. If you establish a set of goals and objectives, there are going to be costs, financial consequences to that. If you decide you want to become accredited, for example, and you're not currently accredited, there's going to be an expense associated with that. If you want to make changes in your operation to improve the efficiency, like we talked about the operational side, if you're trying to reduce the turnover time, there's probably going to be costs associated with that. Maybe you need to hire an additional person in order to help with turnover. Maybe you're going to have to get some type of a computer system upgrade in order to improve the efficiency of the documentation trail. Maybe you're going to decide to go with an EMR system because you perceive that as a way to improve the operational efficiency of your operation. There's going to be costs associated with this. So after you're done with the strategic plan, you should figure out a way to monetize or to identify the costs associated with that, and then go back to the governing body to ask for the resources, the financial resources, or whatever other resources you need to accomplish this. So at the end of the year, as we go into the next fiscal year, this is the time to look back on your finances. Now, we've talked in the past about, and I talk about frequently in public in various meetings that I speak at, about budgeting. I don't feel that many of these small organizations and many of our listeners actually need a formal budget, but they need to have some type of financial plan, and they need to go back to the owners to identify what the expectations of the ownership is with regard to the profitability of the organization, or the level of expenses they're going to have, the staffing levels, the expenditures they're going to have for various things such as education, etc. So this is the time of year to do that. So at least annually, you need to review with the governing body their expectations regarding, you know, both the revenue and expense side of it. I like to say that at the very least, you should be preparing some form of financial projection. You might not call it a budget, but some way of looking for the next year as to what the expectations, as to what the revenues and expenses are going to be. And whether you turn it into a formal budget or not, that's not as relevant as sitting down and actually looking at a plan. So part of strategic planning is not only setting those goals and objectives, but looking at the financial consequences of that. So those of you that have heard me speak in at various conferences know that I'm not a big proponent anymore of budgeting. I don't think that that's very realistic in most surgery centers, but I'm a big proponent of spending the time, you know, every quarter to look back at your finances, both the results that you've had for the past 12 months and kind of a projection or a set of financial statements that look into the future and say, this is what my expectations are. What's nice about doing financial projections as opposed to a budget is a budget tends to be stagnant, something you established at the beginning of the year. And unfortunately, by the second quarter, you're already either above or below, and those numbers become irrelevant. If you use a set of financial projections, which you're updating on a regular basis, those are going to be much more valuable to you. And when you take that back to the governing body on a quarterly basis, you can say, hey, this is what I thought was going to happen. This is what actually happened. These are what caused those changes. You know, how do you want me to adjust this in the future, or, you know, suggest to them what the impact is going to be on the bottom line as a result of that. So again, my new position on this, despite my background as an accountant and my MBA, is that budgeting really is not usually in the average ambulatory surgery center the best way to go about doing financial planning and setting up and establishing a set of financial projections is. And I really would like to kind of dedicate a whole episode to a discussion about how you would put together that financial plan and perhaps provide our listeners with some tools in that area. So also, as we are contemplating the next year, often this is a time that we sit back and say, you know, what other things do we want to do in this organization? Mm-hmm. Maybe we've never done GI, but we have a GI doctor that has expressed some interest. Or maybe, you know, you've never been involved in eye surgery, but, you know, recently a new group came into town, or a new group opened up shop and are looking for a place to do their surgery. And this seems to happen, you know, periodically, especially when a practice relocates or opens up a new office near you. And that opens you up to some discussions that you have to have internally as to what you want to do about that. You know, how are you going to capitalize on that opportunity? Is that something that you can do financially? And to that end, during the California Association meeting in September, I had an opportunity to meet up with my good friend Bob Zaza from Arizona. And Bob and I go way back, probably 25 years. And I thought it would be good to have him talk about how you implement new programs, how you go about the planning for this. How do you determine whether this is something you want to do, and what are the steps involved in that? So let's listen to that interview. So I'm here with a dear old friend of mine. Well, I don't know if we're old, but dear friend of mine, Bob Zaza. He's the president and CEO of Ambulatory Systems Development, LLC. Great to have you on the podcast. You and I go way back.
Yes, John. I'm so glad to get a chance to see you at this annual conference.
I know. Yeah, we're actually recording from the CASA conference out in Monterey. Yeah. And I ran into you and I thought it would be great to have you on. You know, and well, you and I met up probably 2003, I think.
Yes.
With the finance and accounting seminar that first year. And then we did it for a couple years together. I went on. You went on to other things. I continue. I think they keep bringing me back until I get it right. But thanks to have you on the podcast. So sure. One of the things we were talking about before we recorded here is that we've really only started getting into finance topics here. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that you were on the agenda to talk about starting up new service lines, I thought that would be a great topic to talk about. Sure. So you actually just did the session, you know, about a half an hour ago before we recorded here. So tell me a little bit about that session.
Well, right now, with the competitive market in the United States, there's so many surgery centers. There's over 5,000, but 5,500, I think,
right,
now.
Right, Medicare certified.
And they're all Medicare certified centers and licensed centers and accredited centers. It used to be you could have a group of physicians pretty much make it profitable, but it's so competitive right now. And then there's a lot of doctors retiring because many of these centers were developed maybe 20 years ago.
Right.
So the challenge for many of the surgery centers, outpatient same-day surgery centers, are to replenish doctors that have retired, also keeping up with new procedures that the Medicare has approved and other payers have approved,
so
typically following Medicare,
yeah.
Right? And the challenge is to not stay stagnant at your
right.
center. You have to grow to stay alive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can't cost cut your way to profit.
Right.
So, yeah.
What you has can't to cut happen, nursing staff and expect to be able to expand.
There's
or,
only so much.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. That's right.
And in fact, people are adding nursing staff to add to the service level,
right.
which has become a critical factor that is even more important now because. It's so competitive.
Right.
Yes. We nurses are very important.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, personnel is your best asset.
Yeah.
And so as a result, there's been an emphasis on how do I generate new revenue and profit
right.
at my surgery center. And it used to be just go out and recruit some more doctors. Well, that's somewhat more difficult now because of the competition.
Yeah.
Many doctors are already taken in terms of being partners at other centers.
Right.
You can only buy so much equipment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Many of the centers are not large centers. They're owned by maybe 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 doctors at most. So they don't have the financial resources that the large hospitals mm-hmm. or hospital-based surgery centers or large for-profit surgery center companies have. So they have to be very careful with your time, what dollars they spend, where they invest their time and money. They have to do a rifle shot. They have to really figure out the market and where's the best opportunity to generate additional revenues.
Well, and let's make it clear, too, that even if you're doing well right now, that doesn't mean you let up.
Right.
Right. Because anything can happen.
Right.
We had a center, one of our doctors, he was my age, which is very young, and he had a stroke. He was 55 at the time, and he was the largest user of the center. You know, I mean, they were totally unprepared for that, and of course,
I'm living
with
this right now. We had a doctor that was very active, generating most of the revenue of the center, and currently he had some tremors, and he can't do the volume of surgery anymore, and it's really affected the surgery center negatively from a financial standpoint. Now I'm having to go out and recruit some more doctors, but thank God we were doing that anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it really puts a large impact on the center, as you said.
Right.
So what
we're saying is what we're about to talk about is important, no matter whether you're already struggling or whether you think you're doing well at this point.
You've got to continually grow your business. That's
right.
That's the main thing. So you can't cost cut your way out of profit, as we talked about. And then on top of that, aside from, you know, what services that you offer, what doctors are you going to go after? There's a process, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. But also, once you identify those, the pricing strategy becomes very, very key. You know, are you going to use cash pricing? Are you going to offer that? There's a very famous surgery center in Oklahoma that publishes all their prices, so you know exactly what you're going to get when you walk in. And they have some parameters around the fixed pricing. Others do bundled rates, whereas they bundle the facility fee, the surgeon's fee, and the anesthesiologist's fee. It's called a bundled rate.
Right.
We have that in 4 or 5 states now.
Yeah.
It's gotten more and more popular. You have to know your costs to do that, obviously, to make sure you have a profit.
And you have to have a good relationship with all the other parties that are involved in that bundling.
You really have to. And there's a lot of legwork that it takes to get that price right.
Right.
And then there's some risk contracts, which some other people are doing with payers.
Yeah.
Get, you know, if they save so much money on the back end, they get a rebate.
Yeah.
You know, a discount. So anyway, those are kind of dynamics. But typical question I get when a doctor calls us and says, hey, we want to reboot the center. We do a do-over, as we call them. Okay. is what new services should I consider to add? How do I do that?
How do you do it, right? So how do we do that? You know, what's a good strategy for the average surgery center out there? And keep in mind, you know, we're not talking always the big places, too. You know,
right,
small
right.
centers
mostly
have the same
centers
issue.
2 to 3 room centers. Yeah. Now, they're all not 4 or 6 room centers, which typically right. are associated with hospitals or joint ventured with yeah. hospitals. They're smaller centers.
Right.
So, again, you have to be very careful of the dollars and time you spend.
Yeah.
Right? So first thing is you kind of look at what you're good at now.
Right.
So most centers have a particular specialty that they're particularly good at if they're multi-specialty, aside from the single specialty ones, which mm-hmm. obviously it's a spine center, it's an yeah. orthopedic yeah. center, it's an ENT center, it's a GI center. But on multi-specialty, which are most of the centers,
right.
you have to look at what you're good at now. And if you have spades, you play spades.
Right.
But then you have to add clubs. Which suit do you have?
Yeah, right. what's going to match your client?
So first thing you do is we look at a kind of an array of services that are profitable that would be even worthwhile looking at, yeah. right? And those typically are total joints, spine, cardiology, interventional radiology, and nephrology procedures that Medicare has added to the approved list.
Right.
And that becomes the benchmark because the other commercial payers will always follow Medicare.
Right.
If it's not Medicare approved, it typically is not going to be difficult reimbursed by a yeah. commercial payer.
And with the addition in proposed 2020 rule of adding some additional yeah. arthroplasty, is that really going to, I think, help us that, in, along that line?
Absolutely. That and the cardiology procedures yeah. and some interventional procedures. Total knees are coming up. Total yeah. shoulders after that. It's all coming.
Yeah.
So you look at the lucrative other services that could be offered. And let's go see if it fits our particular location.
Right.
So we kind of do a little demographic analysis of what kind of population are we currently serving, what other centers are in our market. And we typically use a 30-minute drive around, not necessarily a distance because it varies.
Right.
And in a very intense market, a very dense market, I should say, like in L.A. or New York, it's 15 minutes.
It could be 2 miles.
If it's in Santa Monica, it's like 10 minutes. Right. There's like, you know, on one street, there's like 7 centers. Literally.
Yeah. Wow. Right.
In Beverly Hills, I used to run a surgery center on every corner, literally on every corner of the street in Beverly Hills.
Sometimes in the same building and sometimes in the same suite.
Correct. There are 10 centers.
Yeah.
There's 4 in one building. Yeah, right. There's 4 in the other building, and there's 2 across the street. Just the way it is.
Yeah.
So then we look at what services they provide now in the competitive surgery centers. And we try to find what we call the ambulatory service holes. What service is not being provided or being provided and not very well.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And can we create a new service that would be outstanding that would attract other physicians in that particular specialty to make it, I won't say a center of excellence, but be a particularly good so that there's mm-hmm. maybe 3 or 4 doctors doing that service that makes it economically feasible to buy the equipment and to provide the services mm-hmm. and buy the supplies.
Right.
So we look at what they're doing well in the market so we don't duplicate it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then this process of elimination, you're taking some services out. Which ones are not being serviced, those identify the ambulatory service holes, we call those. Mm-hmm. And then identify those that which fit best with the current physicians that we have, the current market that we have, the current mm-hmm. location that we have. Can they get there?
Mm-hmm. Right.
What fits best with the doctors that we currently have? Do those doctors have friends in those particular services that are able to be able to come over? Would it be attractive to them from a location standpoint? Is it convenient for the surgeon to come?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Those are all key factors. And then we look at the reimbursement. So we know that we have managed care contracts. We kind of know what the reimbursement is in our contracts. And if we don't have that particular service covered, we ask, say, if Blue Cross or Cigna, if we offered this service, what's the reimbursement like? You know, mm-hmm. try to get an idea of that. And they have schedules.
Right, right.
We're not negotiating it. We're just trying to figure out what it is. We then are able to then do a competitive analysis to bar which surgery centers offer that. We can also do, by knowing that, a secret shopper.
Yeah.
So we'll have one of our nurses or one of our business office people call and say, I'd like to have a XYZ procedure. What would that cost me at the center? And we can understand the charges and kind of work backwards. So we have to do some research as to what the charges are first and kind of work backwards with the reimbursement. We validate the reimbursement with the payers. We have a good relationship with the payers anyway. We said, look, we're considering doing this. Oh, you have – nobody is providing this service, Cigna. Why don't we be your provider? Do you have providers on your panel that might want to come over to this center and make it a really good place to do a lot of it and that we're proficient at that particular service? And the payers are like, oh, yeah, that's a good – you know, believe it or not, they're looking for a place to do it effectively, convenient for their patient, and cost effectively for them.
So, and let's face it, we're in a new market now. People are really looking for quality care, too.
They're totally looking for quality care. Very good, John. And that's exactly the case. So when we identify that, it kind of tells us, okay, this is going to be a good one. Okay?
Yeah.
It's going to be cardiology. And we can only do about three or four procedures right now. We don't have these fixed cardiac cath lab units.
Right,
But that specialty is being expanded procedures are being expanded in surgery centers by Medicare.
Right.
They really want to move it out of hospitals. They want to move it out of more expensive cath labs. And interestingly enough, the cardiologists have not been picked over like all the other typical outpatient surgery specialties.
Yeah.
Same thing is true with interventional radiologists. We've tried to identify those and some vascular surgeons. Again, those procedures are approved by Medicare. They pay well.
Right.
They're not very, very expensive to provide.
Right.
The cardiology, a little bit more so because of some of the equipment and the, the vascular package you have to put onto a C-arm or whatever. But the point is that they are doctors that have not been attractive in the past because they weren't getting reimbursed.
Right, right.
So we're looking areas where we can identify doctors that have not been identified before and see if we can't gather four or five or six of them and make it a very, you know, good service.
As surgery centers start thinking about adding new services, what types of steps do they have to go through? I mean, you know, we talk a little bit about doing cost-benefit analysis or sensitivity analysis. Tell us a little bit about what's the next step and who can do that sort of thing.
First, you have to find a physician champion.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do cardiology, you got to find a really good cardiologist who's excited about adding a new that service.
Right.
So identify a physician champion is a big issue. Can't do it without the doctors.
Right.
So start there, right?
And the nurses too, but the doctors are going to start that.
And they'll know the nurses
that
are good that provide that kind of service because not everybody can do cardiology or interventional radiology. The typical outpatient surgery nurse is not proficient at that because we don't do those cases, right? Do they have the experience and can we get the support for them to do that? So we have to identify the doctor, the staff. Is the space adequate to accommodate the equipment or the electrical or the plumbing requirements?
Right.
Oftentimes they're not. They're older centers.
Right.
So if you're going to do, again, I'll use cardiology as an example, and you got to bring in some additional equipment. Some of these centers are older centers or they're small centers. They're not up to speed on all the – they've gotten the grandfather clause, because they haven't had the new – service. But if you start adding new services, oftentimes they have to jump up the equipment. Or in one case, we didn't have – because we're going to get Medicare certified now because it wasn't Medicare certified to be able to do these cardiology procedures. We had to put in $400,000 literally to upgrade the electrical equipment to get into compliance.
Which has happened a lot with those diagnostic radiologists who are getting into vascular access ASCs. Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. So physical attributes have to be done aside from staffing attributes. Managed care contracts. Can we get the contracts? Can we, in fact, get a good reimbursement from them? So we have to know what our costs are. What's the cost of the implants? Can we work with a vendor? So if we're going to do knees, what about Stryker? What about spine with Boston Scientific? Can I cut a deal with a vendor that will actually help promote the program by giving us some good pricing that will also attract their buyers of that equipment and say, hey, in XYZ Surgery Center, we're going to start providing spine centers. By the way, do you have any doctors that want to be close to that location and start doing surgery? And we've identified doctors through the vendors.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sales reps are very good also in terms of both the general suppliers as well as specific vendors for specific service levels.
Right.
So the spine doctors, whether it be Stryker or it be Boston Scientific, there's vendors that are in that niche that want to help because they want to.
And the incentive of sell more product.
And then do I need overnight stay for these type of patients? Do I have the space for that?
Right. Does your state allow it?
Does the state allow it? Exactly right. Yeah, exactly. And then what about anesthesia? Anesthesia is key. Do the anesthesiologists want to do something like that? Do they feel comfortable doing that? Some of the anesthesiologists don't want to get into cardiology. Right. They just feel uncomfortable doing that in a surgery center. So you have to find providers that are ancillary to just your surgeons and your nurses. So those are all key factors to consider when adding the new service.
So what type of a time frame do you see from the idea? I mean, obviously it's going to vary considerably depending upon, you know, what you're looking into and what your marketplace is. But you got to, this isn't something you do overnight.
No, it's a 6 to 9 month. It could take a year, but typically not that long.
Yeah.
If you have a good physician champion and you have relationships with the vendors, which really helps a lot.
Yeah.
And physically the facility's okay.
Right.
Or doesn't need much modification. You can usually do this in 6 months, maybe less, depending upon it. But 6 months, because you also have to negotiate the payer contract.
Right. Before you start doing the procedures.
That's the longest part, because the payers are slow in working through stuff. They've got they already have their own priorities in terms of trying to renegotiate their contract. I mean their plate's full. So the payer contracts take the longest time.
I think it's also important, since I still do quite a number of feasibility studies myself, do a solid feasibility study. One of my pet peeves now is don't just do the best scenario out there.
Right.
You know, do a break even, do, you know, best case scenario and do the worst case. You know, how do you have, before you get into a project, have a strategy to get out of it if it doesn't work?
Well, we do an ROI on every one of them. We determine how much money is necessary to put the service together. We review the expected number of procedures by year. We obviously cut it, like you said. We do three scenarios on every one of those. Calculate the revenue for those procedures based on research with the payers, based on Medicare pays. We usually run it at Medicare rates.
Right, we do too.
That's
a good
most conservative
idea.
Way to do it. Yeah. Because usually the lowest fees. We cost out the supplies and implants for the procedure. We determine the staffing costs, that's recovery room, operating room, business office, insurance verification person, all the personnel. What does that cost per hour? We review all any other incidental costs, you know, in terms of, again, equipment necessary, the building, if there's any renovation. Yeah. So we actually do a significant profit and loss return on equity, return on investment scenario. And we do it on three different caseload levels.
Yeah.
We bring that to the doctors that are the key doctor first, validate it with, yes, those are the things I need.
Right.
Then we start bringing that to the key physicians. We're validating it with the doctors that are going to participate in that program. Mm-hmm. We show them what the return can be if they continue to participate. And oftentimes, they will want to invest in the center.
Right.
Or if they're already invested in another center, they may still want to come only for the fact that it's going to be a really good service after it gets running up. Mm-hmm. If it's a really good service, the nurses are really good. The nurses that are good attract doctors.
You bring up a great point, is that one of the best ways to attract, I found over the years, is talk to your own nurses about, you know, who's dissatisfied in other organizations right now. Because that's a quick target. You know, they're not going to close the deal necessarily, but certainly they're the ones that can tell you where to start marketing.
Absolutely. They know who's good and who's not.
Brings up another topic, too, is making sure we have the proper staff to do this. You don't want to have eye nurses doing total joints.
Exactly.
Nothing against eye nurses, but, you know, it's not what you did. And likewise, you don't want total joint nurses doing eye cases. Yeah. So
you want the best you can get. So it's like my Italian grandmother, you know, when she talked about making a sauce or a thing. Steal one tomato.
Right.
And so I go to a surgery center and steal the best tomato I can find.
And then the rest
of that particular specialty. Pay her another buck an hour. Or no.
Yeah. Whatever you have to do.
Whatever I have to do to attract
And keep in mind that you might end up having to do that in order to start a service.
Well,
you might
absolutely
have to throw some money at it.
I've typically done that.
Yeah.
And you know what? These nurses are very excited about having a new place and program they can call their own. You got to get them excited. So the if the staff's excited about it, aside from the champion, physician
the
champion,
physician. Yeah.
It really just catches on fire. And it really becomes a fun thing, actually, to do, not just an economic, oh, hey, it's another revenue.
Right.
It's a program, and it's fun.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your business. You and I haven't connected in a while, so tell me about what's going on with inventory systems development.
Well, we continue to do a lot of what I call turnarounds, do-overs, basically enhancing centers that have been opened for a while that need to be refreshed with either new services, new doctors, new revenue cycle, a lot of revenue cycle problems out there. The clinical is very strong. The business office people have not caught up with that in terms of being able to collect. There's a lot of collection problems.
Mm-hmm.
They've hired a nurse administrator who's very good clinically, but not necessarily very good financially.
Yeah.
And as a result, and they've been there a long time, and there's a lot of loyalty to that person, and they're good people.
Yeah.
They just don't have the skill sets given the sophistication and the complication of revenue cycle anymore.
Right.
So right now we're spending a lot of time with revenue cycle enhancements, fixing bad collections that have occurred in the past, working with insurance verification, putting in new business office systems.
Yeah.
We do. We have developed a few new centers and from scratch got a Medicare certified, accredited, or in the case of certain states, licensed. There's no licensing in California, but in most of the states they do have it.
Right.
So you have to go through those. And then we're doing a lot. We're looking at investing in some centers on a minority position, and being able to bring our talent and complement the doctors. There's a lot of physicians, as I said earlier, that are kind of in their waning years, in their 60s, their late 50s, sometimes later 60s,
plus,
that want to punch out or want to get some money off the table. So they don't mind selling 40%, 30% of the center and have it in good hands to keep and sustain their legacy, because they built this. It's their baby. And there's a very good book called Selling Your Baby. It's about people that have started a business, regardless of what it is. They've invested all their money, their talent, their time, their reputation, and at this time to sell it. It's time to get some money off the table. And it's a very hard thing because it's yours.
Right.
There's a pride of authorship and ownership. And a lot of these doctors are at this point now saying it's time to let go of it. So they don't want to let go of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But if they can let go 40% of it, 30% of it, and get some money off the table, it makes their life a lot easier to day-to-day. Turn over the management, so which we do a lot of the day-to-day management through the nurse that's on site. We don't have to be there all the time, but through now communications with online, you can do so much of it. I mean, it's like being there. I mean, it's, you know, and then we physically are present at least once a month, seeing doctors, working with the staff, training them, doing whatever we need to do to, I'll say, enhance the management performance of the center. So that's what we're doing.
And I think a big takeaway, both with our business and yours, is that the industry has gotten so complex now. You know, it's not 30 years ago when, you know, you and I got into it.
Absolutely.
And when an administrator could handle everything.
Yes.
It is, I think it's really almost impossible, except for extraordinary and probably very high paid people. And that's what the whole concept of outsourcing now is bringing to bear here. And I think we have to recognize that, you know, you don't have to go it alone. When I first started my first surgery center in Rochester, New York, I had no mentors. There, you know, nobody else had done this. We were one of the first, you know, we were the first 20 centers in the state. We didn't have anything to go with my, but that's not the case anymore. And companies like yours and ours definitely are a big
part of
this.
I'll give you my story because this is interesting. I was our third year of graduate school in hospital administration. We have to, at UAB, which is a very good health administration program, we have to do a residency. And my residency, a year of administrative residency, because you're in residence.
Yeah.
I can sound like a doctor. I did it in New Orleans when I was 21.
Yeah.
Tough duty.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did it at a fantastic place, Ochsner Clinic, which is the fourth largest clinic in the world. 350 physicians, physically a six-story building, physically connected to a 350-bed hospital at the time.
Yeah.
We added another six stories while I was there. But it was very interesting because I worked for the group practice, not the hospital.
Yeah.
The hospital administration resident was a Tulane guy, and he and I swapped departments just so we could get the experience. It was great. But Dr. Ochsner was a very forward-thinking doctor. He was the doctor that linked smoking to cancer.
Yeah.
He was the head of general surgery at Tulane. he founded the clinic along with four other department heads at Tulane. It was the first multi-specialty clinic in the South. It was the Mayo Clinic of the South.
Yeah.
It still is.
Yeah.
Very big health system now in New Orleans. Anyway, Dr. Ochsner, I was finishing my residency, and I was about 3 months away, and he called me up. It's like being called by God.
Yeah, right.
So Mr. Zaza, always very formal, please come upstairs and I want to talk to you. I was like, and so my boss, who was the administrator, said, AO wants to talk to you. I'm like, what the hell do you want? What do I do now? So I run upstairs and see Dr. Ochsner. He says, look, I know you went to graduate school. He said, you ever hear about this thing called a surgery center in Phoenix, Arizona?
Oh, my goodness.
I said, no, I haven't. He says, what the hell? I thought you went to graduate school.
Yeah.
Bob, what's the matter? I said, Dr. Ochsner, I really don't know. He says, I want you to go out there. And I heard it's outpatient surgery. I'm a general surgeon.
Yeah.
I want to do some outpatient surgery. We had a little space between the clinic and the hospital. There was a building kind of in between,
yeah,
expansion space. I had a little space for it. I think it sounds like a good idea. Go out and check it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Go to Phoenix, spend a couple of days, come back and let me know what's going on.
This is Surgery Center?
This is the Surgery Center of Phoenix, the original
Surgery Center. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So I'm going to call Dr. Reed, Wally Reed, who founded the Surgery Center, and I'm going to tell him you're coming. So he sets it up.
Yeah.
So I go there. Dr. Reed is like lovely to me. The administrator who wound up working for me later on showed me the ropes.
Yeah.
You know, and I had worked in an operating room when I was in college. I used to work in housekeeping, holding legs and stuff like that. So it didn't bother me. But as long as it's not my blood.
Right.
So I felt comfortable in the environment.
Yeah.
And I've been working in hospitals anyways. Great. So I got it.
Yeah.
So I got the business part of it, the reimbursement part. There was no Medicare. This was 1977.
Yeah.
1976, excuse me.
Yeah.
I go back and I said, this is a great idea.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? I said, we're a tertiary care facility. He says, I promised Chris Owens, who's the famous stripper on Bourbon Street that owns the strip joint, that I would do breast jobs on our girls in a very private, clean place. I'm like, are you kidding me? He says, Bob, look, points at this plaque on the wall. It's a walnut plaque with the 15 different stainless steel German instruments that he invented fused together. And he goes, sometimes the practice of medicine and the business of medicine fit together.
Just
like those instruments are fused, okay?
Yeah.
I think this is one of those times.
Wow.
I said, okay. He says, build me the best one you can do in the space I've got.
Yeah.
So my project to finish my residency is when you do that, I'm going to hire you as assistant administrator because we need another guy.
Yeah.
So my project was to build a surgery center. I built my first surgery center in 1977.
Oh, my gosh.
You beat me by 20 years.
I'm telling you, and there was no reimbursement.
Yeah,
it was
right.
All obviously, this was plastic surgery, right? But what a funny story. It was just,
I didn't know that.
I just happened to, totally luck out, right?
Just to be able to see such
totally
a famous place
out.
That
and
we all know
about.
About
a year later, I got hired at Brookwood Hill Services, a for-profit hospital company in Birmingham, moved back to Birmingham, and the first thing they wanted me to do was build a surgery. So I built my second
never
surgery
left center industry
in, 1979.
Oh,
2 years
ago.
This has been great. Thanks so much for joining us here. We'll have to have you back again. I'm sure we got plenty of other stories we can talk about.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take it easy. So I want to thank Bob for that insightful information. So let's take a short break and we'll come back and we'll talk about upcoming events in the ambulatory surgery industry.
You're never alone in the ASC industry. Many organizations are eager to provide an opportunity to keep up on all aspects of running an ASC. And in this section, we highlight some upcoming events.
If you'd like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
As one of the most sought-after speakers in the industry, John is available to speak at your state or national meeting, and the ASC Podcast with John Gailey can even record an episode from your meeting.
So we have a lot of things going on with the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, and many of these events we're going to be attending here and getting content from and doing special episodes from there. And first on that list is the ASCA 2020 Winter Seminars, which are in New Orleans, Louisiana, from January 16th through the 18th. The seminar features three ASC-specific tracks. tax, finance and accounting, coding and reimbursement, ASC management, and I'll be speaking in the finance and accounting track. So it's not too late to get signed up for this conference, but definitely look into it pretty quickly.
The first ASC Nurse Leadership Conference presented by Progressive Surgical Solutions will be Thursday, February 6th and Friday, February 7th, 2020 at McKesson Headquarters in Dallas, Texas. Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies is a proud sponsor of the event, and we hope to record a special episode from there.
So we know that this last week, HHC had its Achieving Accreditation Conference, which is an interactive, in-depth, two-day seminar designed to help organizations prepare for the HHC survey. And their next conference is going to be in Miami, Florida, March 13th through the 14th. If you are considering a change from IMQ to HHC, this is a great opportunity to learn more about what HHC is about.
The AORN Global Surgical Conference is in Anaheim, California, March 28th to April 1st. We'll be attending the conference and recording a special episode there with interviews with some speakers.
The Florida Society of ASC's Quality and Risk Management Conference is April 16th and 17th, 2020, in Buena Vista, Florida.
The Iowa Association of ASC's 12th Annual Education Conference is April 17th and 18th in Johnston, Iowa.
ASCA 2020 is in Orlando, Florida, May 13th through the 16th. It is the industry's most highly regarded and well-attended event. Attendees include physicians, administrators, nurses, managers, and owners of ASCs from across the country and indeed throughout the world. At ASCA's annual conference, you're going to find more than 50 educational sessions designed for ASC professionals at every level, nationally recognized ASC management experts, a lot of networking opportunities with more than 1,000 of your colleagues, and hundreds of exhibitors who can't wait to tell you about their solutions and how it would impact your ambulatory surgery center.
Becker's 18th Annual Future of Spine and the Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management-Driven ASC Conference is June 18th through the 20th at the Swiss Hotel Chicago in Chicago, Illinois.
And the Florida Society of ASC's annual conference and trade show is July 15th through the 17th at the Walt Disney World Resort in Orlando, Florida.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again, and please consider becoming a patron by going to our website at ascpodcast.com and spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.